before we get started with the sermon proper, I want to make sure everybody has this or access to this one piece of paper that has a lot of questions on it. So as you look it over, pick out a couple of questions that are interesting. Because what we're going to do is we're gonna do the little talk to your neighbor kind of thing, and then we're going to have some chance for an open discussion. And this is an interview with the author of this book, Hand to Mouth. This is the book that we read this summer for Southminster Reads. And what you'll get with this little introduction is kind of a basic. So he's telling what life is like as the working poor from a first-person experience. If your ears are tender, it is Bill Maher. I just want to warn there are just two little F-bombs, okay?
But first up, she is the author of Hand to Mouth, Living in Bootstrap America. I think a very important book. Linda Tirado. Hey, Linda. Pleasure to meet you. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Well, I read your book. It's fantastic. It's such an important issue that I think we have to get into, especially here because we're right after an election. Mm. And I thought it was interesting. About only a third of the country voted, and a third of the country is desperately poor. But it's not the same third.
Imagine that.
Yeah. And so just quickly, why is it you think that poor people don't vote?
I mean, look, you're going to give me a party full of rich people or a different party of rich people who work harder on my issues. And, you know, look, there's a partisan divide, obviously, between who's on what side of which issue. And I personally tend to like Democrats. But I'm not going to say that it makes sense. They're dialing for dollars for 4 hours out of their entire day, and then they
right.
take how much vacation?
Right.
Really, if it comes down to us or Boeing, who do we think has the votes in general?
Right. But isn't it also that we should make voting, I mean, Election Day, a holiday?
It's
a lot of times
like
poor people are working two or three jobs, right? Didn't you work three jobs?
I did, actually. And at various parts of my life, I would have kids and husband and jobs, and he was working in logistics. And we're on the bus, and that's like 2 hours there, two
right.
hours back. And, you know, if you don't have your ID and a DNA sample and your firstborn,
right.
and, you know.
Yeah, right.
So you have all these things, and then people go, but it's so easy. Why don't you just go?
It's not that easy. And let's get to that, because your story is so interesting, and I'm so glad that you're really kind of now an ex-poor person.
It's very, very nice, actually.
Yes.
I highly recommend it. Everybody should get a book deal. That's
right.
how we're gonna.
Well,
that's how we're gonna lift America out of poverty.
See, if I was a Republican, what I would say is everybody should get a book deal.
Yeah, you
that's,
know,
that's what Mitt Romney would say. Why can't you just get a book deal like everybody else and pull yourself out of poverty? And
look, Mitt Romney thought he was poor when he was living on his dividends.
Right.
So.
Right.
But what it comes down to is, like, people talk to me and they say, oh, you should be glad you got this. Everything is great. And I go, that's lovely for me. Talk to me about the other 45 million Americans who are living
right.
the same life that I did this time last year. Because we all can't get a spot on Mar.
Right.
I think it's fantastic. Thank you for having me. But this is no way.
But I hope the reviews say Mar is spot on.
Yes, but look, this is no way to run a country. You can't look at somebody and say, oh my God, look at how hard you're working. We're just going to pluck you out, and everybody else, go fuck yourselves.
Right. That is actually in the Republican platform.
Actually, I think it's it, yeah.
But your story, now, I think it's great. I mean, you wrote an article.
No, I was talking to my friends on Gawker.
Is that really where it came about?
It really was, on the back page of
Gawker. The whole thing, why I make terrible decisions?
Yeah, one of my friends.
And it went viral.
Yeah, it went super, super viral.
Right.
And then Penguin said, oh, you should write a book. And I said, yes, because I'm not dumb.
Sure.
And so I did, and that's literally it. It's nothing more than, have you ever stopped to think about the fact that we're not allowed to pee for 6 solid hours?
Right.
And maybe that's why we have a crappy look on our face. Maybe I just desperately want to go to the bathroom, and you're the thing between me and that door, right?
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. And let's talk about the fact that when you're poor, there's just no margin for error.
Yeah, well, we're not wearing our hair shirts properly.
You what?
We're not wearing our hair shirts properly.
Right.
You know, we occasionally enjoy life. We do things for amusement, sometimes out of a sense of, I don't know, humanity. And every time you do that, you're doing it wrong. Like, point to me the poor person who's in the Betty Ford Clinic. just right. or a high-end sex club anywhere.
Right.
Find me the low-income people there. So we know
or who can engage
vices.
In some retail therapy.
Right.
That's and probably not on your list.
Not normally, no. And we know that everybody has vices. It's only the poor people we demonize for them. Because no offense, you have smoked, I'm going to say, some weed that one time. That is not an admission your average poor person would publicly make.
But I was poor, too. I became a pot dealer because I couldn't afford to buy pot.
It's true. Tell me that's a true story.
That is such a true story.
Oh, my God, that's amazing.
I never smoked pot
really
before.
Good strategy.
Yeah, before. Exactly. I never smoked pot in high school. I went off to college. I started
Liked
to smoke
it.
Pot.
Right.
I couldn't afford it. I was like, well, I can afford it if I sell it.
Yeah.
Because you buy a pound, which is 16 ounces, and then you divide it into 17 parts. The part for me, we would call the head tax.
Yes. See, and they say poor people aren't innovative.
No, they are. They are. Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's a hell of a bit of entrepreneurship you're doing.
Yeah, I mean,
right there.
I remember when it was like to be poor, and it sucked. I mean, the only thing I will ever miss about it is the joy of a bargain. I remember when I was first in New York, I bought a jacket, a sport jacket I had on for $5. Mm. It cost me $25 to get it tailored so it would fit me.
But $30.
But for $30, I had a jacket and I wore it every day the first 2 years in comedy, which, of course, the sleeves pushed up because it was 1980. You know, that's how we did it back then.
You can be forgiven for everything you did circa 1980.
But,
you know, here's the thing, though. The thing I miss is the solidarity. Is you don't get that sense of community outside of working class spaces where we all know each other's kids' names and we also know how sick you got that last November, that you have seasonal illnesses, that you're going to need a little bit of help. Those sorts of back and forth, it doesn't exist outside of the working classes because it doesn't need to. You're self-sufficient. And I will say I miss that.
And what I mean by no margin for error is, like, if your car breaks down, if you break a bone, these kind of things, what are you going to do?
Because
you
barely... I once lost an entire truck because I couldn't afford $100 for the tow fee.
Right.
And they keep it, and then they charge you $100 every day for storage, and then you go on your payday and you say, I have that $100, and they go, okay, look at you being cute.
Right. No, I read it in your book. You had an accident, a car accident. Mm-hmm. You got your teeth knocked out. So now you don't have money to fix your teeth, so you can't get a job, because nobody good hires you with no teeth, except, of course, fucking Mickey D's.
Right. Right, and then people look at you and go, why do you work here?
By the way, I brought this, you know, McDonald's put out McResource tips a couple of years ago.
Oh, is this the one on how much to tip your pool boy?
No, it says, don't let the distraction of your money worries prevent you from getting regular exercise, eating healthy, and getting enough sleep.
That's true.
Why didn't you do that?
I mean, I'm gonna be honest, though. I'm gonna be honest, I just hate sleeping.
Another great point you make is when you're poor, you can't really be healthy. They're mutually exclusive.
Yeah, well, I mean, we know, okay, so studies show us that actually performing happiness inhibits your ability to feel happiness when you're off work, all right? So you're already depressed all the time.
Right.
And then you're having to eat convenience food because you're in between shifts, and you know what's really quick? Fucking McDonald's.
Right.
Right? So you go to McDonald's, and you eat the food, and then that stuff gives you a hit of dopamine, and then you go to work, and some guy tells you something, and you really want to punch him in the face, but what you do instead is smoke a cigarette.
I remember when I had a bad summer job once, like, moving tar.
Oh, God.
Like pushing tar on it. And at night I would dream about pushing tar. It's like, even when I was dreaming, I wasn't out of myself. I'd wake up after dreaming about pushing tar and then go and push tar.
Listen, I can explain why there are ads about that woman having castrated pigs, because I worked on a pig farm.
Right.
The smell never leaves you.
Oh, I'm sure.
Never. Like 20, 30 years later, this woman is still haunted by that 1 week she spent castrating pigs.
Right.
Like, because I was there for 2 weeks and I thought I was a champ.
That's just the workers. What about the pigs? They smell too.
That's
right?
True. I think they don't.
What about this? It says at least 2 vacations a year can cut heart attack risk by 50%. Why didn't you think of that?
And it almost makes you wonder, are they trying to actually, like, create heart attacks in their workers when they read this? Because we don't even get paid sick days. Dude, you know, every time you go to a fast food restaurant, they have to sign off and say, like, everybody on shift is visibly healthy, right? That's a crapshoot, all right?
Right?
You go to fast food, you go to any service industry job, whether it's food, whether it's retail, somebody there has the flu. Right. Somebody has the flu, and you just got to hope to God they're really good hand washers.
Right.
But yeah, take a few sick days. That's cool. You didn't need to pay your rent this month.
Well, I wish we had a lot more time to talk about this. Come back and do it. And
absolutely.
Welcome to the middle class. All right, Linda. All right, let's meet our panel.
Linda Tirado, hand to mouth, living in bootstrap America. So what I did is made a number of lists. I'll just read them through. Who's the target audience for this book? What surprised you? What confirmed for you what you already knew? Have you ever been in Linda's position? Do you have a family member in her position? Do those who are well off think the working poor make bad choices? Are they, that is the well off, correct, or are they missing the point? A rule of thumb for poverty, if you spend more than half your income on rent, you are poor. Is that an accurate rule of thumb? What are some of the struggles of the working poor that you hadn't considered before reading this book? And here's a good one. Why are we reading this book and discussing it during worship at Southminster? As a community, what is a takeaway from this book for us? So I'm going to invite you to just gather in a group of three or four. Just go ahead and turn around wherever you want to go. If you want to move across the room, fine, but don't be bashful. Just we're going to take about 5 minutes and just go around and address one of the questions. It doesn't have to be any one. And then afterward, we're going to have a little opener discussion if people want to say something to the group, and I hope you will. Well, what I want to do right now is take 5 more minutes and have a little feedback from you. You have a chance. You don't have to. I don't want you to summarize what your group said or any of that stuff. You just be you. You've had this chance to have your own thoughts, and then you interact with somebody else. And I'm looking for like 10 people to go talk for 30 seconds. So if you've got something on one of those questions, just pick one. Give us a 30-second response.
The thing that really struck me, I've only read about a third of the book. It was a huge eye-opener to how much of my own privilege I don't even see. When I went through a divorce, I had a little startup business that wasn't paying me any money. You know, I got some money in the settlement with my husband, but was, you know, largely broke. And yet, I knew I would never end up on the street. I had my parents as a fallback position in an emergency. My family even paid my health insurance for a year after I got a bladder infection. You know, like I knew I was never going to be on the street. Didn't minimize the stress a whole lot, but after, you know, just reading the dailiness of the cycle of the, you know, if you're throwing up that day and can't make it to your job, not only will you not get paid and maybe not be able to eat, but you might lose your job and then you're really screwed.
Thank you.
So I fell into the camp of someone who would say, someone who's poor makes bad choices, poor choices. And when I was poor, I had that experience in myself, like, oh, well, I keep doing this, I keep getting the same result. But the one thing that she pointed out that stood out for me that I hadn't really thought through is when you're poor, you're usually not eating nutritious meals, so your brain's not working as well. You're not getting much sleep. I know that when I'm tired, I don't make the best decisions, and I'm, you know, cranky. If you have sleep and nutrition, you can make better choices. And the other thing I noticed, I figured out when I was, you know, after college and shortly after, and sometime after college, actually, is when I was most broke. And I could never see more than a couple of days ahead of me. So I could never plan. I could never say, okay, I want to be there. What steps do I need to get there? It wasn't until I had some means that I could actually go, oh, hey, now let's plan the future. And so it's my experience of myself is being stuck in a cycle.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, we kind of talked about two issues, one being the same thing, in that we also say when they make bad choices, that's based on our privileged white minds' choices, that if they culturally have lots of children and don't believe in birth control and then therefore have 8 children, then we want to make a judgment. Well, why do you have so many kids if you can't afford an apartment to house those people? And that becomes our judgment that's not fair on them, that is the decision they make based on their family and their culture and how they believe. And then with the other part we talked about was housing and how, you know, when you have 8 children, even finding an apartment that is even beginning to be reasonable in cost is next to impossible without assistance. And with waiting lists for Section 8 and some housing programs being 3, 4, 5 years in some areas, it doesn't give them a chance to ever get that head up, step up kind of thing.
All right, thank you.
I volunteered for several years down at Julia West House, and I don't know if you know what that is, but it is a an organization that was found by First Presbyterian Church, and it's a daycare, not care, a day center for the homeless, so that they don't need to be on the streets all the time. And I did a job counseling down there. And that was really enlightening to me, because I was dealing with people who were sleeping on the streets, outside, all over, and they wanted a job. And how in the world do you go about getting a job and keeping a job when you are homeless and you have nowhere to sleep? How do you do that? And they mostly could not. And so it became a way of life, this gotta get a job, but I can't keep it because I don't know where I'm going to be tomorrow morning when I wake up, and so on and so forth. So it is just such an awful, awful place. And many of these people, a couple I had known when I was working at Career Makers doing career counseling and stuff, and they were people that I had known there who were bright, savvy, and they were already successful. And here they were in this spot, and it is heartbreaking.
Thank you.
When I did volunteer work in San Antonio, talking to people that were looking for work that were poor, I remember talking to this one young man, and he was excited because he had been hired for a job in a restaurant, but it required a white shirt and black pants, and he only had the clothes he was wearing. And so he came to the center, and thank heavens we had one pair of black pants. But that's all it takes to keep somebody out of the, you know, it, just having a pair of pants would have allowed him to have a job. And so that's how fine the line is between the suffering and not so much.
Thank you.
I work at a school in our district, and the poverty level is so high that every student there qualifies for free breakfast and free lunch. And I'm thinking about between 80 and 100 families on Fridays, or the last school day of the week, get a backpack home with food for the weekend. Some students get them every week, some get them every other week. And in the classroom across the hall from us, this friend of mine was telling me on Friday this week there was one backpack instead of three because there was a new student getting a backpack. Two of the other students who usually get a backpack had gotten one the week before. This was not their week. They were arguing about which one of them was going to get the backpack, to the point where they each had a hold of it and they were tugging and yelling at each other about who was going to get this food. And it really shook up the staff that was in that classroom. And then when my friend told me, it's just incredibly sad that children are feeling the desperation.
Hi, John. First time visitor here and enjoying this experience. What struck me was the naked truth. The naked truth, if we want to see Jesus, we have to see the poor. And at the end of time, Jesus said, if you've seen the naked, the hungry, the thirsty, those in prison, you've seen me. Jesus, who started off as a Palestinian Jewish refugee from the Middle East. Have we forgotten that our heritage? Is there too much amnesia? Have we forgotten our story? But to meet Jesus is to remember that he was naked on the cross. He was thirsty when he said, "I thirst." He was in prison, and we visit him. If we want to meet Jesus, he's among the poor.
All right.
Just a little bit of, recent history. I was very fortunate in the mid-70s to grab hold of the tail end of what was called the War on Poverty. And I was hired to start what was then a community action agency, which was revolutionary in its time because it was the first entity that insisted that low-income people have a place at the table. And there had to be at least one-third of people there making decisions about funding or programs or what have you, who were low-income. And then I went through that and into the Reagan years, and here we are today. I know that I was fortunate to be able to play a role at the community level. But since then, just one anecdote. I remember leaving my office and making sure all the doors were closed and everything. We had a dumpster outside the parking lot. There was a person going through it. This was in the 80s. And my thought was, when this becomes the norm, we have lost our way. And it has become the norm and been the norm for a long time. In the good old days, the government felt strongly that it had a role to play in helping people. Now, we were all idealistic, and I think it was a bigger job than anyone ever thought it would be. And people got discouraged, and then another way of thinking came in that was greed was good, and you know, keep what you got, and don't pay taxes, etc. But it, when I think about how big this is and what Southminster can or can't do, we're doing things already, and even being here is doing something significant. But I feel that we need to reinstill in our society the kind of responsibility we used to have that only large entities can undertake. That's affordable housing, that's subsidized housing. Most of the homeless people that we saw on the streets for the first time in the 80s were there because Reagan had cut funding for housing by 80%. And people wound up on the streets. He also cut funding for mental health. So we had mentally ill people on the street. Point is, it's not just a local issue, and it can't be. Somehow, we have to reorient ourselves back to the balanced, caring culture, dominant culture, that we used to be. And so I just wanted to share that to put it in perspective. It's a hell of a big job, and it's not going to happen overnight.
It's one of the takeaways that I thought from this book, and there are many, and these are good stuff, but one of the things I was thinking is be kind, you know. She came out in her book all the time about, you know, people judging people for buying a pack of cigarettes or whatever it is, to recognize what cigarettes do. You know, tipping the gas station attendant, that is a lousy job, by the way, pumping gas. But those kinds of things, I think, would also go a long way. As the political action is definite, I'm on that completely, but also just the personal action of being kind and taking from another's perspective, I thought was really powerful. Thank you for engaging in this.